All rise. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 070784, consolidated with 070785, Harry Holmes and Others versus Douglas, Beatty and Others from Harris County and the 14th Court of Appeals District, and 071065, Earl Hagen versus Doris Hagen from and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Green will be participating in each of these cases, but he could not be here this morning. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we will take a brief recess after the first two are argued, the consolidated cases. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready now to hear argument in 070784 and 070785, Harry Holmes versus Douglas Beatty.
Court. Mr. Hogan will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Justice, and may it please the court. There are many interests that come together in this appeal. Married couples have an interest in seeing that their written agreements are enforced. The securities industry has an interest in uniformity of its forms and nomenclature. The legislature has an interest in seeing that its statutory language is given effect. And the general public's will, as reflected in the Constitution, is also an important interest. All those interests are aligned in giving effect to written agreements in which a married couple decides that marital property can be given to the surviving spouse when one of them dies, without going to court and without having to probate a will. The accounts and the securities at issue in this case are survivorship property. First, the written agreements signed by Mr. and Mrs. Holmes meet the requirements of sections 451 and 452 of the probate code. Section 452, as enacted by the legislature after a constitutional amendment, allows spouses to create a right of survivorship without the use of any particular words or any magic language.
But it does make it awfully easy.
Yes, it does.
Is it the bank's fault that they don't follow the statute, or why is this so complicated?
Well, it's really not complicated, Justice Hackett.
Well, I mean, why don't they just pick out one of these phrases and stick it in there, and then there won't be any question about it?
Well, that would be easier, Judge, but it's not as if Raymond James flips to the Texas probate code and decides that that's the way that they're going to write their forms. We believe that the depository institutions in this case have nonetheless reflected a clear intent that this should be survivorship property.
But these two could have made it very clear just by following the form. I mean, there was a way in which they could either strike out B or you know, make it very clear they wanted a joint tenancy with right of survivorship, and they didn't do that. Why shouldn't that decide the case?
Your Honor, you're referring to the Dane-Rauscher agreement?
Yes.
That agreement has two possible choices. It has either a survivorship choice or a percentage interest choice. Now, both of those are survivorship choices. In the Dane-Rauscher account, the parties clearly signed on the form that said that it had an interest in survivorship property included in the account. To choose the second option, which would have allowed them to give less than 100% of the property to one of the spouses or to someone else, that would be a survivorship option, they would have had to have filled out the blanks on that form. They did not do so. And under the handout which we've given to the court, that agreement is contained under tab 3 If you look at the second page of the agreement in the Dane Rauscher account, the very last sentence on that form says, if paragraph B is retained, fill in the names and percentages amounts of the interests. They did not retain paragraph B because they didn't fill out the percentages. Now, it does violence to the party's intent to take this agreement under tab 3, which is entitled Thomas J. Holmes and Catherine B. Holmes, JT10, and say it is not a survivorship interest. JT10 is known throughout the industry, throughout all of the practicing people in the securities field, as joint tenancy containing a right of survivorship.
But you can have a joint tenancy without a right of survivorship.
No, Your Honor, you can't.
Cannot.
No. There is a type of property called tenancy in common. But JT10 is defined in the Securities Association handbook, in the Securities Transfer handbook, as JT10. Let's look at it as an example of that, if you would, at tab 4 of the handout. Now, this is a stock certificate that was one of the certificates or securities issued out of the Raymond James account. And it's titled Thomas J. Holmes and Catherine V. Holmes, JT10. If you flip to the second page of that certificate, this is the reverse side, you'll see that the legend is contained on the back of the certificate consistent with the way it's used throughout the industry to indicate that JT10 means as joint tenants with right of survivorship and not as tenants in common.
Does the industry usage indicate anything about the intent of the parties?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. Throughout these agreements, the parties in signing the agreements agreed to bind themselves to the customs and usages in the industry. In the Raymond James account, they signed an agreement that said that they understand and agree to be bound by the customs and usages of the applicable exchange. In the Dane Rauscher account, again, we see that the JT10 language, which is consistent with the way the industry uses the language, is survivorship language. The First Southwest account contains this agreement that all transactions shall be subject to the Constitution, rules, regulations, customs, and usages of the exchange. And likewise, the Principal Financial Group agreement says that it should be subject to the regulations and customs of exchanges, markets, clearinghouses, and the National Association of Securities Dealers. And that's typical. With a 50-state operation, a company like Raymond James or First Southwest or any of these other companies don't want to have separate forms, one for Texas, one for Missouri, one for Kansas. What they expect is, and consistently with the kinds of certificates issued, as in this case, that the industry nomenclature will be followed and that when people sign up for these accounts, they've agreed to do that.
452, that section is part of the Uniform Probate Code, correct? So is there a majority or minority trend on how to analyze or have these facts been presented in other states?
No, Your Honor, not that we can tell. There are cases in other states, and we cite a couple of them in the brief, in which abbreviations are consistent with the intent of the industry. For example, the term JTWROS is a term in some of these agreements. JTWROS, as this court did in the A.G. Edwards case, stands for a phrase that's permissible under 452 to create a survivorship account. JTWROS stands for joint tenancy with right of survivorship. And as in the Raymond James account, we've included this form under tab 2, that's the kind of phrase that 452 says you can use to create survivorship language. And what 452 says, and this is quite important, we think, in permissive language, is that the agreement shall be effective without including any of these phrases. So it's not simply a matter of flipping to that section of the probate code, cutting and pasting the phrase into the agreement.
Whose intent do we look to? Is it the brokers or the beneficiaries?
Your Honor, we submit they're the same intent. Obviously, you would look to the intent of the spouses.
I mean, WROS, we stop people on the street,
What do you think JTWROS is? 99 out of 100 are going to have no idea. Now, if it's in a right of survivorship lawsuit, it jumps out at us, and of course, we all know what it means. And probably in the brokerage industry, everybody probably knows what it means. But how can we be sure? And it's interesting, the statute just says there has to be an agreement. It doesn't really say whose intent we have to have. Could parties sign one of these not really having ever thought about whether it was right of survivorship or what would happen in case one of them died and not the other, and have it still be binding because this language is in there?
Well, I suppose it's possible that somebody wouldn't know what those initials mean any more than people wouldn't know what FOB means or COD means. But in a uniform commercial code contract, if it says FOB, you don't have to spell out freight on board to know that the risk of loss passes at the time that the cargo's loaded. Or COD means, you know, care of delivery, and you pay for it when it gets there. We give effect to those terms because those terms are consistently used throughout the country. And what we know that these people meant, in this case, we have sophisticated investors, and in the Raymond James Agreement, as you'll see behind tab 2 of the handout, they'd been investing in securities since 1940. Their occupation is listed as investments. We know that these people did both ways. They sometimes created accounts that had tenants in common effect and would have created community property accounts, but oftentimes, as is reflected in this case, the dispute about this property is survivorship property because the clear intent of the parties says so. It says so consistent with the way that the securities industry says that it's created. And in a permissive way, the legislature has said that's okay, that you can do it the way that Mr. and Mrs. Holmes wrote and signed these agreements. Well, obviously, they didn't write them, but they signed the agreements that the industry said that they should sign in creating survivorship accounts. The property went into these accounts as survivorship property because the account agreements governed the property when they were in the accounts. When those certificates were issued out of the accounts, they invariably said JT10.
But JT10, okay, you can't have tenants in common, and that's without a right of survivorship, correct?
That's correct.
And when you look at 452, all of these examples of where the rights of survivorship are the parties agree to it, they have the term survivorship in them, 1 through 4. With right of survivorship become the property of the survivor, surviving spouse shall pass. So why shouldn't we read JT10 as merely a tenancy in common? I know industry standard, but I wouldn't have known that before, if that's the case, before this.
Because, Your Honor, we hold people bound to the agreements that they sign. We don't let people escape the effect of the agreement as a term in the agreement is defined, simply by saying, well, I didn't know that that's what it meant. What if somebody came in and said, well, the initials JTWROS don't mean anything to me? It's an invitation to fraud for somebody to sign that agreement, not ask a question about what JT10 means, which could have been explained easily.
I'm just trying to analyze it, though, compare it with the probate code itself. And it seems like, you know, there might be a legislative intent that says at least you have to have some concept of survivorship in the term or the agreement that you're signing.
Well, you do, Your Honor. And what we say is, and what we submit the court ought to do, is use ordinary contract interpretation principles to interpret what a term in the agreement means. If you had to go to the Securities Association transfer book and look up a definition of JT10, which you can do in any legal dictionary in this country, and find out that JT10 means it has survivorship qualities, if you had to do that to explain the term that's in the agreement, if you had to look up in the dictionary or in the securities industry and see what JT10 means, if it wasn't on the flip side of the certificate defined as it is in the Texaco certificate, if you had to do that, that should be permissible in this instance because the legislature said you don't have to use those magic words. It gave examples. It did not give, as it did in Section 439 of the probate code, for people who are not married a specific magic language way to do it. In this instance, the legislature in Section 452 said the agreement shall be effective without including any of those phrases. And
it's not clear to me whether you think 452 and 439 should be applied consistently or differently.
Your Honor, we think that they can be applied consistently in one sense, but differently in another sense. That's probably not very well said, and I apologize for the confusion. But it's consistent to say that the legislative intent is given effect in both sections. But it is a different legislative intent because the policy behind allowing spouses to do something is far different than in the example that Your Honor had in the Stouffer versus Henderson case, in which there were two sisters involved. Or when there are unmarried people involved, it's different. And the legislature said, say these magic words, and that's all you can do to create a survivorship right when people aren't married. But when people are married, it's natural and it's normal for the wife, if the husband dies first, for the wife to get that property and not have to go to probate court and probate a will to get the assets that were community assets in the marriage to survive to the spouse. In Section 46 of the Probate Code, we know that the legislature has said that Part 3 of the Probate Code, Chapter 11, apply to spouses. And that's for a very good reason, for this exact kind of case in which the survivor ought to get survivorship assets. And the legislature says do it differently if you're married and does it in a permissive way that's not required in specific terms as would be required in Section 439. Now, all that you have to do to interpret these as ordinary terms in the industry is to look at ordinary contract interpretation principles, which this court does all the time in wills, in statutes, in deeds. If you look at the industry norms and you apply consistent contract interpretation principles, we submit that this court ought to decide that this is survivorship property, that it should have passed to Mr. Holmes at the death of Catherine, and we'd ask the court on that basis to reverse in part the court's decision.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument now from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Horgan will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. The key to this case, the two keys. Number one, ownership in the survivor. There has to be some indication here that the survivor takes an ownership interest in the property. That can be vest in, belong to, pass to. He gets it and he owns it. But we have to show that what it is that we're talking about when we use the term survivorship. The survivor obtains the property in an ownership right. The second key to this case, in my mind, is fraud. We have to be extremely careful when we are interpreting or tinkering with this legislation that resulted in 452, 451, 452, in 450, and in 439A, that we do not open the door to fraud by one spouse against another spouse, bearing in mind that a husband and wife are in a fiduciary relationship. This is why in 451 and 2, we talk about a written agreement signed by both spouses. Now, let's take, since the one account that the Court of Appeals did not agree with me on, and I have my own petition for review before the court. Let's talk about Raymond James. Joint, paren, WROS, closed paren. The court, that's the account where there were 14 different choices. And the Court of Appeals said, well, you checked joint WROS, therefore, and there were other names there, one of which was tenants by the entirety, one of which was tenants in common, one of which was joint community property. Court of Appeals says they didn't check any of those others, ergo it had to be joint tenants with right of survivorship. That's what joint WROS meant. That assumes that laymen, people on the street, know what those initials mean.
What else could they mean?
They could mean joint tenants without right of survivorship. They could mean joint taxpayers withhold registration of securities.
Mr. Hogan says that first option doesn't exist in the law. Joint tenancy without joint tenants. Right of survivorship.
My response to that is, I believe it does, and at least in some jurisdictions. I think it means the same thing as tenants in common. My other response is, how in the world are laymen supposed to know that?
Well, how in the world are laymen supposed to know that when they execute a contract and there's a little clause that says you're going to be bound by an arbitration agreement, and some years later, so I don't know what that means. The court consistently holds that, well, it's too bad. How is this any different?
Well, I think when you have a statement that you're going to be bound by arbitration, I think the word arbitration means arbitration.
Who reads those documents? You know, if you want this car, you sign it. If you want this house, you sign it.
I'm glad you raised it, Justice Medina. In the Raymond James client agreement, which the other side says we must look to, there is an arbitration provision saying any disputes are going to be decided by arbitration. And they say that the client agreement really was an agreement between the husband and the wife. We say it was agreement between the brokerage house on the one hand and the husband and wife as one entity on the other. Now, if arbitration governs, why are we here?
Because both parties can waive arbitration.
But no question, nothing was raised about arbitration. The arbitration provision.
Right, like any other, if both parties agree impliedly or expressly after the fact, they can skip it. But the question is, what would, I understand it could have been more clear, but you've got 14 options and you pick one for WROS. First, you say joint tenant can be the same as tenant in common. Seems to me just, if I hadn't been to law school, tenant in common separates two people that own one thing. Joint tenancy sounds more like they do something like a joint venture together if I was just a business person. So they sound different. Can you give us anything specific of where someplace joint tenancy exists that is without right of survivorship?
I can't tell
case,
you.
Case, statute,
no,
nothing.
No, but I can tell you that JTTEN is not what is contemplated by the legislature in 451 and 452, nor in 439A, because JTTEN does not tell a layman that we're talking about survivorship.
But the back of the certificate defines JTTEN as
right?
Joint tenants with right of
right.
survivorship.
But what about the back of the certificate? Is there a written agreement between the spouses? No. Do both parties sign that stock certificate?
If they both sign it, why isn't it an agreement between the spouses?
But they both didn't sign the stock certificate.
Well, they signed the, okay, we'll take, let's first with the account agreements, and ones, things they did, they both signed though, and that's agreement between the spouses.
Right.
And if then the account officer, from money in the account, they buy the stock and they hand the stock to them, why isn't that governed by the account agreement?
Why is it not?
Yeah.
Because the certificates came out of the brokerage house. They were withdrawn from the brokerage house by Mr. and Mrs. Holmes. When they were in the brokerage house, I think it's arguable that they were bound by the agreement, assuming the agreement was clear.
So what if me and my spouse have an agreement where we're going to buy something with right of survivorship, and then I go out and buy it and take title myself? I mean, why does that make the agreement saying it's taken, what I'm going to do is with right of survivorship, why does that take it out of the agreement?
This is the very reason that I talk about the danger of fraud. Think about it a minute. Husband and wife have stock in street name at a brokerage house. They decide that they're going to withdraw that stock and do whatever they want to do with it. So they agree that that's what's going to happen.
What do you mean withdraw that stock?
I mean tell the brokerage house, folks, we would like to have our stock certificates out of that.
Right, so the stock certificate and the street name is handed to them. I don't see why that changes it. I agree with you. If the stock brokerage calls up somebody and says, cancel the shares and issue the shares to their names, that seems to me like that would take it out of the agreement. But if we've got it in a street name or joint ten or whatever we've got it, and the company's holding it and was bought pursuant to this account agreement, when they hand it to them, why does that take it out of the agreement?
First of all, it wasn't in the form of a certificate when it was in the brokerage house. It was in street name. So they had to issue a stock certificate in a form that was different than what was contemplated what was stated under the account agreement. Bear in mind, in the Raymond James, it was joint paren WROS, whereas when they issued the stock, on the face of the stock certificate, it was JTTEN. Some of those certificates had a legend on the back defining JTTEN. Some of them didn't. If I may, I'd like to speak to Justice Brister's question about what else could you find in those 14 choices. I'd invite the court to look up the term tenants by the entirety in Black's Law Dictionary. What it says is it's just exactly like joint tenants with right of survivorship, except it is peculiar to a husband and a wife. That's the way it's defined in Black's Law Dictionary. Now, are lay people supposed to know that tenants by the entirety is a term that is not permissible under Texas law?
But it looks to me as if what really happens is that somebody goes to the banker or broker, whoever it is, and says, this is what I want to have happen. And it's likely, isn't it, that the banker checks the box based on what he's been told.
I don't think it's likely that the banker checks the box. I think it is extremely likely that even the banker doesn't know what it is that is being determined when that account agreement is signed. I went to a bank the other day, not the other day, but several months ago, asked for an account in the joint names of my wife and myself. I just wanted her to have signing privileges on my account. What I got by way of a form was a survivorship account agreement. Now, I had enough legal knowledge to know that's not what I wanted.
Isn't that what most people want?
Oh, I don't think so.
Most people, you're married to somebody short or long period of time. It's your joint account, like a bank. It's where you keep all your money, all your community property. One of them dies, they expect the other one not to get any of it.
Well, when you...
That's just the opposite. If it's the whole idea of having both of you sign on is when you die, you expect they can still use the account, right?
Well, you may or may not. Because, bear this in mind, Your Honor. Number one, it wreaks havoc with estate planning.
I know lawyers don't like it. Of course not.
And
but most people don't want to hire a lawyer when they open a bank account. They want this to be quick and cheap and not pay any lawyer's fees. And isn't that, if that's what most of them want, isn't that why we passed this amendment to the Constitution? Because that's what most people want.
I think the court is imposing its knowledge respectfully on what some folks want and some folks don't.
Why would they have amended the Constitution? Before the rule before the constitutional amendment was exactly what you say. It's got to be very, very clear. It's got to say this precisely. But they amended the Constitution for some reason, and clearly they amended it, you'd agree, to make it easier for spouses to leave right survivorship accounts.
Agree with that.
So that has to be because they thought most people wanted to do that, didn't they?
No, I think it's because they thought some people, and maybe most people, found this to be a convenient way to do things. Bear in mind that 50% of the marriages today end in divorce. And we've got children by prior marriages here. And that's what Mrs. Holmes was trying to do in her will.
Do you agree that
It is an industry standard to use JTWROS.
An industry standard?
That is common in bank accounts and some of these brokerage accounts.
No, I agree that that is one of the things that people, that companies in the financial industries use.
And the reason I ask that is if we were to say that doesn't establish a right of survivorship, I'm just thinking about all the contracts and agreements that are out there today where that was the intent, where two lawyers go into a bank and they see JTWROS and know exactly what it means and they sign thinking that if I die, it's going to go to my wife.
Right.
And if we hold otherwise, that's going to upset, it seems to me, a lot of intended survivorship contracts.
Well, I'd respectfully submit that the court needs to take into account that is not what that does not comply with 452, and respectfully, it is not what we can say a husband and a wife necessarily want. The burden of proof here, and Justice Brewster touched on it when he talked about amending the Constitution, the burden of proof here is not on us. It is on the folks that are trying to establish right of survivorship. That's the exception to the rule.
Now, precisely why does the JT-10 language not satisfy 452?
Because it does not give the customer any hint of survivorship. It does not say anything about the property vesting in, belonging to, going to, owned by. It says nothing like that.
And what about the example of a contract FOB?
Well, I think IRA is common knowledge. I think FOB, you ought to know it. You and I know what.
Well, that's a good point. You ought to know it.
Why would you ought to know FOB and you ought not to know JTROS?
Because I think it's a legal term that is not common knowledge to a customer of a brokerage house. You and I know what NRE means.
Contract, he says we're just using ordinary contract principles on this. And if ordinary contract principles, you incorporate the definition. You can incorporate definitions, can you not? You use FOB and say, see the definition. Say, we have an insurance policies that everybody has. See, and he says we just use ordinary contract principles. You're talking about everybody knows or everybody doesn't know. It seems to me like, why don't we just look at the contract, as counsel says?
Here's the problem, respectfully, with ordinary contract principles. If you use ordinary contract principles, and if you have JTWROS, for example, that, in my mind, raises an ambiguity. And ordinary contract principles would say, let's bring in extrinsic evidence of intent so that we can resolve this ambiguity.
It sounds like that's what you wanted us to consider. Maybe I'm wrong. When
I'm sorry,
you said that's what Ms. Holmes was trying to do in her will. She had extra children, and so you're asking us to look beyond the contract there.
I'm looking at the will. The will passes her property to her children by her first marriage.
We have all these documents to consider.
I'm sorry.
Are we considering her will or these documents?
We're considering her. I brought her will up to show that it is not necessarily the way people want to pass their property, i.e. to their surviving spouse.
Is there any ambiguity in the law of what JTWROS means?
Well, I think it's a yes, I think there is ambiguity.
Not what a non-lawyer might think it means, but under the law.
Oh, under the law? I think lawyers know what JTWROS means.
It's not ambiguous under the law. Aren't we all bound by the law when we sign a contract? We're bound by the legal significance of what we sign. You said people may not understand exactly everything in the agreement. A big part of my practice in the private world for 12 years was securities. And brokers would sell mortgage-backed inverse IOETs. People didn't know what that meant unless the broker explained it to them. If there's something in the arrangement that they're going to sign off on and agree to, don't they have a duty, since they're bound by what they sign, to understand what it is? If there's something they don't understand, to get that worked out before you sign?
They would have that duty under ordinary contract principles. But when you have a specific statute that says that agreement has got to indicate survivorship.
Careful, counsel. It says the agreement, an agreement that otherwise meets the requirement of this part, however, shall be effective without including any of those phrases.
Right.
Like survivorship.
Right. And that's where the, and of course some of the.
After you agree under the statute, the agreement in this case does not have to say survivorship or any derivative of that word for it to meet Section 452 necessarily.
I do, Justice Strangman. I agree with that. But it, when I use the term it has to show survivorship, what I'm really saying, it has to show ownership in the surviving spouse. It has to show an ownership interest. Because 452 gives examples that don't use the term survivorship. It talks about vest in, belong to, owned by. It does, they don't use the term survivorship either.
And I agree with you in the blended family situation where you've got two spouses who get married with different kids and have wills that want to leave them to different kids. If that's what they wanted to do, why would you create a joint account in the first place? If the whole idea was, look, I want my stuff to go to my kids, your stuff go to your kids, and that's fine with everybody, why would you put all your stuff in a joint account?
Some folks want it and some folks don't.
I know, but why would you do that if you want to keep things separate in the first place?
Oh, I think it's community property. And you can, if you've got a joint account, a convenience account, it's very common for a husband and wife to have joint community property in a convenience account in Mary or John Doe. But that's not getting down to what happens to the property upon the death of a spouse. And if it's put in a convenience account, Mary or John, that leaves it open to pass by virtue of Mary's will if she dies first.
What do you make of Mr. Hogan's point, pardon me, that the parties agreed to be bound by the customs and usage prevalent in the industry?
Well, I think they agreed to be bound by the customs and uses in the industry vis-a-vis an agreement by them on the one hand with the brokerage house on the other. Not an agreement between the two of them.
But not in terms of vernacular used or terminology or what those terms mean?
Correct. Because first of all, the client agreement that is an exhibit here that is in the Raymond James account, number one, you go from the account agreement, which 452 speaks to, and then they want us to leapfrog over to the account agreement. Then they want us to leapfrog into custom and usages. And when we do that, then we get into extrinsic evidence, affidavit from a broker that had nothing to do with this case as an expert witness. We get into the securities handbook. We get into the securities rule book. That goes far beyond what is contemplated under 452.
Your view, usage does not include usage of vocabulary or terminology.
Not usage that is common to brokers, but not to laymen. You and I know what NRE means. We know what WOJ means. I submit to you that the folks on the street don't know what those terms mean, and they have a right to. Under 452, if they're going to have an understanding of how their property is going to pass upon the death of one of them. And let me say this. Think about this.
If you'll close with this.
All right, sir. If extrinsic evidence is supposed to come in about the intent of these parties and the one spouse dies, who is going to be left to testify about intent? The surviving spouse to whom the property goes. Now, if that's not an invitation to fraud, respectfully, it is. And bear in mind this. These stock certificates that came out here. There is nothing. Please, I'd ask the court to review Ms. Lisa Hyde's testimony before the Senate Jurisprudence Committee, which is set out at some length in our brief. What Ms. Hyde said to the committee was, we've got these stock certificates that there's no written agreement about, but somebody's going to take the position that those stock certificates, because they say JTTEN on the face, ought to go to the surviving spouse. And she says, that's not what we want. That's not what is contemplated here. And, in fact, that's how the statute was passed, based on taking Ms. Hyde's testimony before the Jurisprudence Committee and going forward.
We'll take that into account. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Please, the court, Mr. Lauter will present rebuttal for the petitioners.
Court, I'd like to just point out that given the permissive nature of 452, how easy the legislature made it for spouses to agree that property is survivorship, it's hard to believe that a spouse in Texas is going to be required to hire a lawyer to interpret whether their brokerage firm has given them a document that that does the job. And should they have to hire a lawyer to tell them that their survivorship agreement still applies when they take a stock certificate and put it in their lockbox?
Well, no, can't they just ask the broker? I mean, when they sign the joint account agreement and they see initials they may not recognize, say, what does that mean? And the broker has a duty to tell them truthfully and honestly what that means. And if the broker says this sets up a joint account with right of survivorship, then it better well do that, or down the road we know who's going to be liable.
Yes, right? Your Honor, that is precisely.
You don't have to hire lawyers.
But that is precisely what happens. But if
the brokerage,
the
brokerage has lawyers.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they have lawyers that advise them to fill off these forms.
We don't believe.
Why don't they put this little language directly from the statute in these forms? Then there's no. This problem goes away.
They have 50 states to deal with. They should. There's no question they should get it right.
Had lawyers looking at what the law is in all 50 of those states, surely.
But what.
And survivorship is probably pretty common among all 50 states as well.
Yes, Your Honor. But what they do is they use these abbreviations throughout the industry, and they use it in every state. The associations that deal with transfer of securities all use these same abbreviations. There's one meaning for joint tenant. Joint tenants with right of survivorship and not tenants in common. And not tenants in common. So if a customer... An uninformed customer, which we don't have here, an uninformed customer comes into a brokerage house, doesn't know what those strange initials are at the top. They ask their broker, and they're told all the person has to do is look it up. It's every broker that has the same rules. It means joint tenancy with right of survivorship and not tenants in common. That means they can tell them it goes to your spouse when you die.
If it's separate property, does that go under 439A?
Yes, Your Honor. This only applies to community property.
Now, you're not suggesting that custom and uses trump state statutes, are you?
No, no, Your Honor. What we have in the state statute is a call for an agreement, which calls Texas contract law into play.
Okay, because uniformity is a good goal. Efficiency's very attractive, and the industry should strive for it. The statute should strive for it. But in securities, it's not unusual for young lawyers like me 20 years ago to do a 50-state blue sky survey to find out how the law differed in 32 of the states, was same in 15, and differed in a third way in two or three others. So securities firms, brokerage firms, are not unused to having to do different things in different states if statutes require that. So uniformity is a goal, but uniformity doesn't answer the entire question, does it?
No, Your Honor. But all that's required in Texas, it's easy. All that's required is an agreement between the spouses that in some way, with some words or abbreviations, calls for survivorship. And that's what we have here, because we have abbreviations that only have one meaning. And it's part of the contract. It's not, you don't have to go look at some other document. It's in the contract. Joint 10 is in the contract, or JTWROS is in the contract. So we're not looking at extrinsic evidence. We're looking at what's in the contract. And all we need to do is to look at a dictionary or look at the handbook to say what that word means.
Mr. Lawton, would you please respond to the second key of your adversary's argument that we don't want to open the door to fraud here?
Yes, Your Honor. I personally think the bigger risk of fraud is with a party signing a contract and then later claiming, or actually her heirs later claiming, that she didn't know what that meant. Or, and it's even worse than that, you sign a contract that says joint 10 on it, you get statements for years that say joint 10 on it, you get certificates that say joint 10 on it, with a definition on the back that says joint tenancy with right of survivorship, then later claim, I didn't know what that meant. That is a bigger opportunity. We don't have fraud by either spouse in this case, but that's a bigger opportunity for fraud in the general scheme of things.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Lauder. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.